Good evening, friends, and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. We meet on a regular basis to spread broadcast the teachings that are ancient in nature, but had been passed down verbally until the mid-1800s, 1875, when the founders of the Theosophical Society began writing these ancient ideas that we are so lucky to have today. And mainly what we're doing is spread broadcasting those ideas. We are keeping it in the light, so to speak, so that these ideas might find people of like minds, and so that we can all think the same things together and and maybe spread some light on the world. It says that the work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take in part of side issues. What we're doing here has no connection with any mundane idea. We are trying to lift our own thinking, our own energy to a higher spiritual level so that we will be strong enough to continue to spread these ideas. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. So these ideas are inculcated, but mostly by independent devotion. We come together to help answer questions and to put these ideas out, but in order for it to go on, we have to do this by independent study to help and teach others. And to do this, this lodge has two weekly meetings and one monthly meeting. On Sundays, we have an overall idea of the path of spiritual evolution. I'm sorry, that was January. For February, the overall title is Life Problems and Theosophical Solutions. And for this Sunday, we will be having a panel, and it's the problems with pride and prejudice. And the doors open at 10:30. The meeting begins at 11 and runs until 12. On Wednesdays, we have a study class in the Ocean of Theosophy, and the doors open at 5:30. And the library is open until 5:30 to 7:30, and there's always a student in there to assist in any endeavor you would have for private study. There's the reading that we're going to be focusing on that night is available, as well as the reference to go along with it. And on the book table is open before and after all the meetings. And on the third Fridays, as today, we have a study class to fulfill the one object of the ULT, which is comparative studies of philosophies and religions. And the doors open at 6:30. The meeting runs from 7 until 8. And March 18th's meeting will be Patanjali's Yoga Aphorisms. And tonight we are studying Sankaracharya's Crest Jewel of Wisdom. The lodge is financially sustained entirely by voluntary contributions. Its activities depend similarly on voluntary offerings in time and work. All are invited to participate, but no obligation is imposed or implied. So, Tonight's class is, we're studying a wonderful little treatise, The Crest Jewel of Wisdom by Sankaracharya. And the way we will work, there will be two short talks, and then afterwards plenty of time for questions and discussion. And please just listen to, we will be putting out some quotes from his books, from his writing. And just listen to how similar it is to everything that we study in theosophy. It's almost as if he's sitting here in this room, and he's up here on the platform, because what he is putting out is just wonderful, wonderful ancient ideas. So we will start the meeting, the class then, with learning about Sankaracharya himself, where he came from, his influence in the world, his philosophy, and how it is still current today. Well, Sankaracharya, the name itself, Acharya, is actually Sanskrit for guru, master, or teacher. So it's a title. The last part of his name is a title which he has earned. And there's a disagreement as actually to the date that he was born. But it was somewhere in the neighborhood of 788, and he died in 820, so he was not very old when he did die. And he was born approximately 51 years after the death of Buddha. He was born into a Brahmin family in a town called Kaladi, and it is in a southern India coastal state of Kerala. His parents were childless for a very long time. And please note the similarities between his conception and birth to some of the other great teachers. His father had a vision that was from Shiva, and Shiva told him that he and his wife were going to give birth to a son. But he gave him a choice as to the life that that child would live. The first choice, he would live kind of a mediocre, mundane kind of a life, but he would live long. The second one, he would have a very short life, but his life would be very influential, and he would be a very important person. So the father chose the second choice, that he would live a short life, but would be a very influential leader. And so it was. And it was an immaculate conception as well. And it is said that when he was born, that his birth was not just the fact that the dream was given, but it is said that nature thrilled when he was born, and that his childhood was unusual from the moment he was born. Well, even before, you know, the conception and the pregnancy and the whole thing was totally different. So he was precocious as a child. He knew, he had mastered all the Vedas, and he recited extensively from the Puranas and the epics, and he had learned all these teachings by the age of 12. And it was said that he was a student of Patanjali, but he wanted to be an ascetic. And even though he died at the age of 32, he did travel widely throughout India, and India was his focus, was his attention. He felt as though his calling was to change some of the ideas in India. He established schools, and he started four what they call mutts, M-U-T-T-S, or monasteries. And there were four of them, one in each corner of India, and each one was based on a different Vedantic tradition. During his life, there was fierce opposition towards the Vedic traditions. But his aim was to restore India's belief in the Vedas. And he did this by working from within. He didn't come as an outsider saying, you have to do this, 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 and this. He came in, he got in, people respected him from day one. They knew he was a special teacher. He came in and into the schools, and he taught differently. So he was changing all the ideas from the inside, from the foundation, not forcing people as an outsider. So his whole, so he worked within the traditions, and he managed to change them back from a belief on based on form instead of idea. He changed them so that people were looking at them as pure knowledge and spirituality. And these ideas are still current in India today. And the form that they're called is called the Advaita, we believe that's how it's pronounced, the Advaita Vedanta. Let me just wanted to read something about the Advaita Vedanta. The essential identity of the Atman and Brahman is the most important tenet of the Advaita. Brahman is the substratum on which all phenomena are experienced, and also the one Lord who dwells in all beings. The innermost Atman, the real self, is identical to Brahman. Liberation, and the idea of liberation is very central to his teachings, because his feeling is that once one realizes that there is that one, as he put it, Brahman or Atman, that and that all is central to it, that makes people, that will liberate one, because then we won't be looking at the material side of life. Liberation consists in realizing this identity, not just as a matter of literal or intellectual understanding, but as something that is to be grasped by the individual in his or her own experience. The secret doctrine states that Sankaracharya is one of the greatest of the esoteric masters of India, as well as the greatest initiate in historical ages. And the monasteries, or the mutts, protected his teachings. And he taught them to a Brahmanic order called the Smartva. And he considered them to have the high ideals, advantages of heredity, and discipline that would best secure the purity of the teachings. And it's interesting because in the ocean, and this explains that there's one section in the ocean where it talks about India being the protectorate of the ideas. But it never goes into detail, so we're wondering then if this is the background of that statement in the ocean. And there's a belief that once more is known of Sankaracharya, he will have a place amongst the choicest spiritual aristocracy of the world as a seer and thinker who towered above his race as Plato towered above the Greeks as a great man, an elder brother of the race whose thought and insight mark a tide of human life. And as we said earlier, he was recognized immediately as a great teacher, because he was able to mesh all the beliefs together and just pull out the spirituality of it and get beyond the idea of form. Some of his accomplishments, which are very, very many of them, are too involved and numerous to go into, but the next talk will be about the Crest Jewel of Wisdom in more detail. But he did write many commentaries on the Upanishads and the Bhagavad Gita, and he wrote catechisms to instruct his students on the spiritual path, and he established systems of reform and discipline within the Brahmin order that are still being followed today. But it is not enough for the, and this is from the book, The Crest Jewel of Wisdom, but it is not enough of the mind to follow the lucid sentences of Sankara. Quote, freedom from the bondage of the world demands something more. Sickness is not cured by saying medicine, but by drinking it. So a man is not set free by the name of the eternal, but by discerning the eternal. The teaching must be woven into life and character if it is to bear fruit. So the same thing as we say about making theosophy a living power in your life. It is not enough to contemplate the virtue of freedom from selfishness and sensuality in the abstract. So his philosophy then, to kind of tie it together, the Advaita Vedanta, was about non-dualism and to impress the reality of man's divine identity and reject the finite idea of human life. So it's just what we study, that about materialism and the material body and the form, that it is the inner man, it is the thinker that is important. That the true self is Brahman or the divine creator, that perception of I that we have. And that the bodies are manifold, but there is still the divine essence in them. The phenomenal world is not apart from Brahman, but is one with it. The divine alone is real. And he feels as though through intense practice of the concept of Advaita, the ego and the ideas of duality can be removed from the mind of man, as there is no difference of the self and the outside. Sankara's philosophy is based on three levels of reality: Brahman, the empirical world of beings and non-beings, and reality. His theology maintains that seeing the self where there is no self causes spiritual ignorance or avidya. One should learn to distinguish knowledge from avidya to realize the true self or Brahman. He taught the rules of yoga and karma to enlighten the intellect and purify the heart, as the Advaita is the awareness of the divine. And it's interesting that we did find that there were quite a few similarities to Buddha and Sankaracharya. The missions of both are very related. You know, they look, wanting to get rid of the form idea, but making it more spiritual. But it is said that it was different in form, though, the way they taught, rather than the substance of what they taught. What Buddha failed to do working out of the system, Sankaracharya accomplished working within it. Sankaracharya's ideas are more philosophical, but the Buddhas were more ethical, and both were considered to be sixth rounders. So we just have one more reading, and then we will go on to our next talk. And just because he wrote the commentaries on the Bhagavad Gita, it's amazing how really similar, you know, what a lot of his crest jewel is about. He who through wisdom discerns that there is no division between the eternal and the manifested world bears the mark of one who is free, again that idea of liberation, even in life, whose mind is even when honored by the good or persecuted by the wicked, bears the mark of one who is free even in life, in whom all sensuous objects put forth by the Supreme melt together like the rivers and streams that enter the ocean's treasure house, making no change at all, since he and they are but the one being. This sage, self-conquered, is set free.
For almost 2,500 years, a small treatise, pretty much known in the East, but not known in the West, called Vivekacadamani, came under the notice of William Q. Judge. At a certain time in the history of the Theosophical movement, when HPB was in London, on several occasions she was visited by a chela of the Mahatmas who were behind the movement, and this chela's name was Mohini Chatterjee, and you may be familiar with some of his works we have in the various volumes. Well, it was this individual who took this word, Vivekacadamani, which literally means Viveka is a winnowing of the wheat from the chaff, a separation of the wheat from the chaff, and Damani or Mani is a jewel in Sanskrit. So he's the one who took this word and translated it as the crest jewel of wisdom. Now, this is not an actual jewel. It bears to mind the idea of the philosopher's stone that the alchemist talked about. It was not an actual stone that transmuted metals into gold, but rather referred to an alchemical process by which the application of wisdom or philosophy could transfer the base, lower human nature into the higher, or gold. And it is this same way that this jewel of wisdom, or this philosopher's stone, by winnowing out the wheat from the chaff, the true from the false, helps one get a better discernment of spiritual reality. So Mr. Judge, we know that he translated the Bhagavad Gita that we use and the Patanjali Yoga aphorisms. He began the translation of the crest jewel of wisdom from the Sanskrit and published a good deal of it in the Oriental Department papers, which we still have in their original form in our volumes. Other theosophical duties called upon him, and he couldn't finish it, so he specifically requested one of the theosophists at that time, who he stated in public had a natural and profound understanding of this particular teaching, to complete the translation. And that individual was Charles Johnson, and of course, the crest jewel of wisdom that we use and was just read from is Charles Johnson's translation, and Charles Johnson was but completing the work begun by William Q. Judge. So this book for ages then had been regarded in the East as the authentic message of that great master of wisdom, who, as said, is a sixth rounder, so he is on the same level of development as the Buddha or the Christ. And he says right at the beginning that this book is not for everybody. He said it is especially for those who seek liberation. And we get an idea of what he meant by liberation. He did not mean becoming an ascetic and withdrawing from life, but to be free even in life, to be liberated from the tyranny of the personal self, from the various apprehensions and worries we have when we're too much concerned about that personal self, and from selfishness. So these are those people that would profit from his teachings. But he went further and he said that there are four qualifications that have to be met. And if we, in our own nature, can say that we have met these qualifications, then we're ready to be taught by him. And it's interesting that it was mentioned that the title of honor, Acharya, is a teacher, but it's a special kind of teacher. It means he who causes others to go forward. So one is coming to him, having reached a certain level in their own development, and he's going to be the teacher who is going to guide them to go forward. And he brings this out in the beginning that even though ultimately we have to gain this wisdom within ourselves, it cannot be outdone without a teacher, a wise teacher of compassion and wisdom. So, under the guidance of a master, the disciple has several tasks set out before him or her. He must study his human nature. He must understand the laws of life and the world in which he lives. And so some of the content of the Crest Jewel of Wisdom does exactly that. It looks at the various principles of the human being, the various vestures and vehicles that the human being uses, the laws of life, the processes involved in the transformation, the use of those vehicles, and the world in which we live, understanding its real and its unreal aspects. And he says, as the mind is the cause of the disciple's bondage, most of his teaching is given over to the transformation of the lower mind of thought, feeling, and passion to that of the mind of intelligence, cleansed and illuminated by the light of spirit. So in theosophical parlance, we might say it is the transformation of the lower mind into that of the higher mind, or buddhi manas, which through which the disciple has direct knowledge of the divine wisdom, and that wisdom then is the bridge to liberation. Since all of his various treatises, it's mentioned that he did comment on the Vedas and the Upanishads and the Bhagavad Gita, and he incorporates them into much of his teaching. He did write many original treatises of his own. And one of the central teachings that you see in all of his treatises is this idea of the four qualifications. And of course, much time is spent on these qualifications in the Crest Jewel of Wisdom at the outset, that we thought we would focus on that, because this is literally a book that you could pick up to any page and find not just one jewel, but many jewels. So the first qualification is we look within ourselves and ask ourselves, are we ready to move forward with Shankara? Is discernment between the eternal and the non-eternal. Have we developed the understanding and the conviction that that which is eternal is enduring and everything outside that is unenduring? So we must begin to discriminate in life That which in ourself, that which in the world around us is enduring and eternal and of the spirit, and that which is not. In the voice of the silent is the separation of the sat from asat. And it's very, even in the Bhagavad Gita, we see that teacher, Krishna, pointing out the distinction between that which is enduring, the self, and that which is not. So this seems to be a method by which all teachers begin wanting to begin. You have to begin with an understanding of what is real and eternal and what is not. Having said that we understand that, the second qualification is, have we already freed ourselves from self-indulgence in the fruit of works? Krishna would say, have we begun to detach ourselves from the fruits of our actions? Have begun to give up the desire for benefit, for personal reward from the results of our actions? So, and also it is freedom from any wish for sensory enjoyments of this world or another, freedom from the love of reward. So we have to have reached this degree of, we might say, detachment. So we have to have discrimination, detachment. And the third qualification is that of quietude. And a quietude is a code word for a number of virtues and it actually is the one that he spends the most time on explaining. And it is, since it is a holding of the mind and heart steady on the goal, it is mastery of the mental emotional nature, it is mastery over the senses, and quoting directly from the Crest Jewel of Wisdom, it is refusing to lean on external things, including formal religion, rites, ceremonies, and rituals. Notice the similarity between his teaching and that of Krishna, when thou hast developed a high indifference to that which may be read, and a difference to rituals. It is the bearing of all pains without rebelling against them, unconcerned and unlamenting. So it means we not only bear all pains, we might say suffer in silence, but even within our own nature, we don't complain about it. He who finds no fault. So Krishna says, now I'm ready to reveal this teaching. So in a sense, Shankaracharya is saying the same thing. You have to reach that point where you not only outwardly have not complained, but even within your own nature, you're not lamenting and unconcerned. And then you can be moved forward. It is the power to endure heat and cold, pleasure and pain, and all that comes from without, practically from the Bhagavad Gita. We can see, as was pointed out, how he's constantly quoting from the Upanishads, the Vedas, the classics, incorporating that tradition. He's working within the system. Quote, it is a firm conviction of the truth of the teaching and the word of the master. Interesting. A conviction, a devotion to the truth and the teaching of the word of the master. It is a continual staying of the soul in the pure eternal at all times, and not caressing of imaginations, and not the caressing of imaginations, not giving ourselves over to fanciful wishes of this or that thing in our minds, but beginning to discipline our minds to stay focused in the whole. Notice the one-pointedness and concentration. A certain degree of that has to be developed. We almost might have to say that one has to become a pretty advanced disciple before one would be able to fully benefit from his teachings. And yet, Mr. Judge translated this for the theosophists of his time and our time. So obviously there is much there that would be of benefit. And finally, the fourth qualification is the desire for liberation. The desire for liberation. And we think he states it very beautifully. We'll quote it. It is, quote, the ardent desire for liberation from the fetters forged by non-wisdom, through discernment of the real nature of the divine self. Devotion is most important for liberation. It is fixing the heart on the true being of the divine self. So, having reached that point, then he begins to instruct step by step. Now you can move forward to your own understanding of this wisdom, and from that gain freedom while in life.
It was stated that this book is not for everyone. Is it for mystics, for occultists, or for ethicists, people that are concerned with the exoteric but are very ethical and want something practical, guideline for living? But is there any?
Well, it is interesting that in his teachings, even though he says it's not for everyone, because not everyone may have reached that desire and initial understanding, yet the way he teaches is like you're in elementary school. He doesn't overwhelm you with high metaphysics. He gives one practical examples from everyday life. It's almost like Jesus is teaching his parables, but he develops from that an example of these high metaphysical ideas. So that it is expressed in a language using metaphors in such a way that anyone could understand them, and very practical ideas. So perhaps later we'll read some of his ideas. And as was said, it's almost like he might be on the platform expressing profound theosophical ideas, but in an everyday language that the individual could immediately pick up and use.
Well, also, too, we would think that folks that maybe are not ready yet to change, because it's definitely withdrawing from the material pleasures of the world. And if one is reading this and is realizing everything that they would have to give up that they are perceiving as important, then they wouldn't be ready for this yet either. Yes.
And that giving up, though, would begin in the mind and heart rather than the physical plane. Yes. But doesn't Theosophy teach that Sankaracharya was a reincarnation of the Buddha himself?
I can't speak. Yes,
HPB says that in the tradition of the lodge that the Buddha, Sankaracharya, and Tsongkhapa were reincarnations of the same divine spiritual being. That does not mean that the personality we know as Buddha later incarnated as the personality we know as Sankaracharya, but that spiritual being in the Hindu context, they would call it the avatara. In the Buddhist context, they would call it the Dhyani Buddha. That same spiritual being incarnates like a ray and illumines the personalities of these successive characters. So they draw their wisdom from that same divine ray or source. Yes?
There was so many similarities also to the Sermon on the Mount, especially when you were saying that not only the outside stimulus, pain, you don't give into it, not even personally, is the same thing as slap your one cheek, turn to the other cheek. But there were so many similarities there. There were so many similarities in not just what he was teaching, but the idea that his last name is a title. And I mean, this is so consistent that the personality, you know, the way we're taught to see these people is Jesus Christ. Christ was his last name. Gautama Buddha. Buddha was, that's where we think. But it's always these titles, and the titles give you an indication of who and what they are and what they're about. But the similarities in a lot of this is just amazing. Because the Sermon on the Mount wasn't meant for the masses. It was meant for those who were ready, those who had already perfected themselves to a certain degree.
Well, it's interesting because those of us that have been consistently coming to these Friday night meetings, I mean, there's a thread, that thread of the ancient wisdom. I mean, that is the whole purpose for us studying these comparative religions, is to see that, that these ideas are not new, but to have them in writing where, it, you know, they're in bookstores. You know, people are just kind of browsing through, and who knows what seeds are being planted out there. But it's a consistent thread throughout, you know, all, you know, from ancient times forward. These ideas, no matter what the current political climate is in the countries, they're kept secret if need be. And like he gave them to the Brahmins to hold in safe security. And now we have them here, and we're able to freely talk about it, you know, hand out pamphlets to people when they come in, anything. Is this a follow-up?
Yes. Okay. One of the things that's different, though, he wrote a great deal of these avatars. They don't write, they don't, someone else writes it after they're gone. And the other thing, I don't know if you know it, but what class was he born into?
He was a Brahmin.
He was a Brahmin. He was born into the Brahmin class.
Yes, it's interesting that he did write and the others did not put anything into writing, even those who were said to be six-rounders. And we think that the reason he wrote so much is, remember, he was working in the within the system. Yes, he was a reformer, but he was a reformer who, reforming from within, was constantly referring to texts from the Bhagavad Gita, from the Upanishads. So he had to write continuously showing how this ancient tradition among the Hindus themselves was pointing towards a definite doctrine that was lost, and it was going back to that. So he wanted people to be able to go back to their own sources and follow. It's sort of in the same way that as students, when we are teaching, we are putting forth the ideas of theosophy as recorded in the writings of H.P.B. and William Q. Judge. We're not giving our own revelations or ideas or understanding, but that which is recorded in the teachings. In the same way, he was doing that. We did want to just read a few things about the Supreme Self, that which the disciple is searching for, to try to understand that which is eternal. And as you're listening to it, just listen. Of course, Mr. Judge and Charles Johnson are translating, but listen to the way it's translated and the phrases used. And we begin to understand how much we are indebted to this teacher. I shall now declare to thee the true nature of the Supreme Self, knowing which, freed from bondage, a man gains final liberation. There is a certain eternal self on which the consciousness of selfhood rests. This is the witness of the three fields of consciousness. This is the witness of the five vestures. This is he who perceives all things in the waking, dreaming, and dreamless sleep. This is the true eye, which perceives the intelligence and its activities. whether they be good or evil. This is he who perceives all, whom none perceives, who illumines the intelligence and other powers, whom none illumines, who penetrates and upholds this universe, whom none penetrates nor upholds. From him this universe derives the light with which it is illumined. We can go on, but you begin to see how many references and images he uses to awaken the mind, and just goes on and on like this, to the reality of that self, the I, as the witness, the eternal self.
In the back.
Interesting, we all hear and connect with different writings in what was presented, and we heard a lot of the voice of the silence. So we were thinking, depending on the time period, it would seem that these ideas are represented, as was just described, this was an inward, you know, within the system, whereas often it's outside or it's not recorded and so forth, and it would just be what's needed at the time. But we had a question. The first presenter, we forget the word used, but it talked about perhaps a small group that we would imagine might have been disciples. Was it smart?
Oh, the Smartva Brahmins.
Smartva Brahmins. So would we consider those disciples more devoted or more revealed to that group? Do you know?
Well, the impression that we got was that this was when he established the monasteries, that these were the Brahmins that he trained. He did train them. And then they were given the occult teachings to keep, so that no matter what else went on in India, that these teachings would always be kept safe and pure. Did you have...
Well, we've read Smartva, and we've also read Smartava, and we believe that they were a sect of Brahmins, that there are sects within the Brahmins. And it's interesting because the word smart comes from that. That's the etymology.
We wanted to just to follow up on the previous comments that HBB tells us that a good deal of his teachings are secret, and were not written down, but were taught directly in secret to his disciples in these cases. So there was an esoteric side to his teaching as well, which we would expect that he entrusted to this particular group. And yet, as he went around teaching in the various schools, he had a very specific public expression whose purpose was to help them change from within. Mm-hmm. Their own system.
Yes.
Well, just as he was pointing to ancient texts and clarifying and referring to the book, HPB did the same thing. And it was Gandhi who credited HPB for his pacifist movement because she reintroduced him to the Gita, which he had been told by all the scholars was stuff and nonsense. So he gained an appreciation for his own wisdom in his own country through the writings of Theosophy. So it must always happen that way, I guess.
Yes, thank you. Yes.
And what came up also in the first part was about the teachings being kept for future generations, being kept safe. And that actually came up in last Wednesday's class, and there was a reference in the secret doctrine. Specifically, it said the ideas or the sacred texts are held in subterranean caverns, and very descriptive ideas. And with the rise and fall of land masses, we imagine that as things change in that way, they become unearthed at the right time, like the teachers coming on the scene at the So, and we believe the reference was to it being the Aryan race as a whole that those teachings belong to, but that
specifically the area was where India is.
It really is wonderful to think when we talk about that we all will always have a friend, that these ideas are being protected for thousands and thousands of years now, that they're coming forward, and they will always be safe. They will always be protected. And just to know that there are these elder brothers behind the scene that are protecting them is a very comforting thought.
We also wanted to mention, in light of that, HPB tells us that the Advaita school of Vedanta Hindu philosophy is the closest exoteric expression in the world to the inner teachings or the esoteric teachings of the secret doctrine. So it is the closest public expression in a formalized way we have to the secret doctrine. We might say that prior to the publication of the secret doctrine, which the closest thing to the ancient wisdom that had been preserved in secret for ages was Sankaracharya's work, his public work. So that's why she speaks of him as one of the greatest sages in historical times.
Yes.
He was a student of Patanjali, Sankaracharya, is that correct? Now, was Patanjali's, did he work within the system also, or was he an outsider?
Oh, we're going to take that up next month.
Okay. Yes.
If we could bring a modern-day reference, we were thinking about the ideas being kept safe. We remember a scene, we think it was in one of the Indiana Jones movies, where he is choosing the cup that was the cup of Christ. And when he enters, finally goes through all the trials and tribulations of getting to the last step of the puzzle, there's an archaic gentleman that must be hundreds of thousands of years old and says, finally, you're here. It's your turn to keep everything safe now. And he sort of crumbles and dies away. So it's an invitation that, yes, although the ideas will always be held safe, it is we in these studies who are on the path to taking up that duty someday. We can't depend on those elder brothers without thinking of
that. Yes. And it's interesting, is it not, that this document, Vivekachitananda, which was translated and had been in existence for 2,500 years, which in its origin was meant to bring Hinduism back to its roots. By the time Mahatma Gandhi's on the scene, it was all lost again. He didn't even know of his own tradition. It was through theosophy that he, studying with two theosophists, that he was reintroduced to the Bhagavad Gita and later the Key to Theosophy. And so here we have Mr. Judge translating this essential document, making it available to theosophists, and from that becoming part of the world literature by which there could again be this true understanding of this ancient teaching. So sometimes when we're preparing for this presentation, we're thinking that for the person on the street, they'd never even heard of this individual, and would wonder, well, what is the practical value of his teachings in our modern times? Well, one only needs to pick up the book. And even if one in their own mind is not prepared to take the steps personally, they will certainly understand themselves a lot better and what needs to be done. Because it's like a surgeon. He takes apart our human nature, each one of its flaws, and tells us the specific remedy that we have to do to correct it. Now, we have to make that decision, but the path is so clear, clearly laid before us.
Well, just to follow up on what you just said, if you take the path from these ancient adepts who kept the wisdom alive and bring it to the present, and what happened with Gandhi,
But we also have Martin Luther King because of Gandhi.
Yes.
So it is very relevant and very present. We were thinking about the Indiana Jones twist.
Uh-huh.
It is said that when an adept is leaving the scene, he must speak the word of wisdom into the ear of another adept before he can die. So there's a reality based on that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we would like to read just something that is interesting, because if somebody just off the street would pick up this book, it says, "He who is single-minded, fixed on the word divine, his steadfast fulfillment of duty," and you know the whole idea with duty, "will make the knowing soul within him pure. To him whose knowing soul is pure, a knowing of the self supreme shall come, and through this knowledge of the self supreme, he shall destroy the circle of birth and death and its root together." So, but we think that if somebody would come to these ideas, they not only we think that they would have to be maybe even just starting their search, but just reading some of them, if somebody could be searching and doesn't know that they're searching, you know, just picking something up like this, and as was said in the beginning, just opening it up to any page, there would be some, a little nugget, a little seed that could be planted. Yes?
Would a volume like that be available in a Barnes & Noble, and would it be the right version? Is there any?
Well, the volume referred to is available
yes.
online
yeah,
through Amazon.
Okay.
It's a translation from Charles Johnson. Now, I don't know if these are still available here, but this is the original translation that we obtained from an older student here 3 years ago that was originally published by the Theosophical Society in 1925.
Now,
incidentally, we wanted to mention 1925. That was, of course, around the time that the ULT here in Philadelphia was formed, February 17th and February 18th, 102 years ago. Mr. Crosby and seven other students founded the ULT in Los Angeles, California. So that was, this book was put out.
Wow. There are no coincidences. If one would want to get this, like was said, you just make sure the translation is by Charles Johnson. And we know that one of the differences between these two volumes is that this one has other writings of his in it that aren't in the little one.
You can read it free online.
Yes.
Yeah.
Or it's very, very cheap if you want to buy your own copy.
Yes.
In the book, The Crest Jewel of Wisdom, does Gordon Enyart's teachings, does Karacharya refer to as below, so above, or the sevenfold nature of man?
Yes. He does discuss the four vestures or the four vehicles. And you know, in the yoga philosophy, at HPB discusses the secret doctrine that the sevenfold division can be broken down into the physical body, the subtle body, and the causal body, and the supreme self. And each of those bodies, he explains, the subtle body includes what we would call prana and the astral, the causal body would be more what we call manas and buddhi, and then the supreme spirit. Well, we did want to close our meeting by just flipping through the page here and picking out randomly something to finish our meeting with. Recollection. Standing firm in the eternal, let no negligent loss of recollection be permitted at any time, for negligence is death. Thus spoke the master Sanat Kumara. For him who seeks to know the true self, there is no evil like negligence. From it comes delusion. From this comes the false I. From this comes bondage. From this destruction. Loss of recollection overthrows even him who has attained to knowledge. If he turn towards sensuous allurements, even as an evil woman brings her paramour to destruction. As the green scum on a pond, when pushed aside, does not so remain even for a moment, so glamour wraps itself about even the wise man who looks back. Look not behind, or thou art lost.
Thank you.